the vote to open the meeting. I need a motion to open the Finance Committee meeting.
Seconded.
All in favor?
Aye.
Thank you. Let the record indicate it is 5:09. I need a motion to approve the minutes from the committee meeting held on March 9th.
Favorable action.
Seconded.
We have a motion for favor. We have a second. All in favor?
Aye.
Thank you. First item on the list, PCR 37-20, the bid package. Number one item, 2020-082, streetlight conversion and maintenance, found on page one. Luke?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm here to present, Luke Murray from the Planning Department, here to present the award of contract for street lighting conversion and maintenance. I'm going to attempt a screen share here. I know there's going to be a lot of question on this. This is a fairly large purchase. So I put together a short presentation to kind of show where we're at. So bear with me. Can everyone see that on their screen?
Yes, I can.
Okay.
We can see it.
Perfect. All right. Looks like we're in business. For those that are aware, this has been a long-term initiative of the city. It's going on for some time. I'll give you a really quick timeline as we go here. But first, I wanted to address why we're undergoing this effort. And it really comes down initially to the numbers. Just to cut to the chase, we're at, even on the latest financial documents, about $700,000 in saved for energy and maintenance for the city if we undergo this effort. That's a substantial sum of money I know that we could use right now. And I would say at this point, it's fairly conservative, mainly because our numbers didn't reflect a recent tariff increase. I believe it was upwards of 7% on our maintenance from National Grid. So if anything, this number is conservative, also held a conservative number on what we actually pay currently to National Grid for our maintenance. The $540,000 in National Grid and OER incentives, these are incentives that are provided for these street lighting conversion projects, specifically for these. So about $322,000 is from National Grid, about $300,000 is from OER, and then we have about $200,000 from OER, and we had an additional $10,000 kicker for me going to a smart energy conference, so that worked out. So our simple payback on this is 3 to 4 years on a $3.1 million investment. For those who remember, there was an approval for Rhode Island Infrastructure Bank bonds in, I believe it was January for this effort, at $3.2 million. We're not expecting to exceed the 3.1, but we have a little bit of cushion if we need it. And depending on how much we eventually borrow, we'll be working on that through the process. There's about $3.5 million in savings over the 10-year life of the bond, which is, again, significant. So it really comes down to a major initiative to save money on the city. And I think there's many other tangible benefits here. And it's important to know that the current energy and maintenance increases plus inflation are outpacing the interest rates on the bond. I believe we borrowed the street lighting money at 1.2, 1.3%. Don't quote me on that, but interest rates are still phenomenally low. So based on the future value of money, this is still a great endeavor to do right now. It's likely interest rates are going to go up, and basically paid back by everything where all the energy savings, the maintenance savings. The other things that are tangible benefits, we're going to be lowering our energy consumption. So just from a green aspect, about 70%. We have the ability to customize the system. So as we go into the design process, if there's a constituent request to add a light, take away a light, I know many of you have had made requests in the past. We can do that through the process. Improve constituent response time. So many of you know, we typically go to National Grid. We have to get our streetlight repaired. Sometimes it takes months. That will be cut down to weeks, if not a week, if not a day. So that's a pretty huge benefit to our constituents, the city as a whole. I won't get too far into it, but there is a potential that RIDOT may put on the table for them to acquire what streetlights are on state roads. That's being discussed now, but they will not acquire them until a LED conversion is complete by the municipality. They've been clear on that.
Good, I'm at home, I'm on a
city. And so the ability to adapt smart city technologies is also a big one. we can eventually adapt to smart grid systems if we want. For those of you who know, you can add cameras, you can add parking lot sensors, et cetera, et cetera. Some of this we won't use right now, but we'll at least we'll have the ability in the future. So the work to date, this started in November, and National Grid provided a consulting firm free of charge to us. And thank you very much, National Grid. RPM, Rethinking Power Management, they've been great. They've guided us through this effort. I've worked with them very closely. They've run the numbers and the financials. We worked from January, May of 2019, reviewing LED technologies, fixtures, control systems. Honestly, I had to get a little educated on many aspects of the systems. And then we worked on an RFP, a very long, carefully crafted RFP. And that's what your decision tonight is going to be based on, is that RFP and the outcome of that RFP. That was issued in July. We allowed more than enough time to have respondents come back with bids. We received those bids in September, and we had it was 3 to 4 months of review of that, again, very extensive in the process. So the contents, just so you know, it includes lighting design. They're going to be running financials, includes products, final product selections, the LED conversion and maintenance, converting your lights, inventory, integration to our existing GIS system, which is very important for us to track and manage the lighting system in the future. Install of the controls. We're going to be reviewing different types of controls that we can use. Install and refurbishment of the lighting support poles as required. Warranty and non-warranty maintenance and post-conversion, and then call center operations, which is key because we're taking on a huge infrastructure and we don't have the ability in-house to really manage and respond to those concerns. So we're going to be counting on that third party to really take over call center operations and manage the system going forward. It also requires installation by licensed electricians to National Grid standards. So we're assured that anybody up on those poles is going to have to meet those standards, National Grid standards. For those who are thinking schedule, we have 150 calendar days to do the full LED conversion, and I'll go over our schedule very briefly in a minute. The first year of maintenance is included in the base bid, so anything happens to that fixture after install due to workmanship is covered. 10-year warranty on all of the fixtures, so that's manufacturer warranty, which is pretty nice because if we have any failures, it's covered. 24/7 call operations, 5-day normal response time, 2-hour emergency response time, and compare that today with National Grid. And like I said, sometimes that's months. Then monthly reporting to city on all repairs and issues. And that would prospectively go to Jim Owens over in facilities once this project is done. So there'll be a 3-year maintenance contract. I want you to note that you're only approving a 1-year contract now. The idea here is that we'll come back in a year and ask for a time extension. And that'll be a good time for the council to get an update on the progress of where we're at with conversion. I would expect that the conversion would be about 80 to 90% complete. We can get an update on the call center status, and then hopefully we can extend that to the full 3 years that we have on the contract as far as it did. We required various options on the streetlight system. I keep referring to design. We haven't selected a final fixture yet, but all of the pricing is very comparable. So it's going to be really coming down to pilot studies in the field and making sure that they are suitable for our city use and our needs. So the RFP was issued in July. We had 17 contractors, vendors, and industry professionals emailed directly about this to make them aware. We had 24 vendors attend the pre-bid meeting. We had 8 proposals received on that September 18th, and all lighting contractors were on the vendors list that we submitted. So the encouraging thing, we had a great response. Everybody we contacted responded. And keep in mind that many of these vendors are not local, they're national. So we had responses from all over the United States for this effort. We had a rigorous 4-month review process. The scoring was done by myself and 3 members of RPM. 2 of the 8 members failed to meet the basic requirements. So by that, I mean, they did not meet the technical portion of the requirement. They're basically 6 of them submitted binders of all the technical skills. 2 thought they were fine just submitting pricing, which was not appropriate. And we disregarded those 2. We narrowed that selection down to 3. After a scoring of both technical and price proposals. And then we did interviews with them. And then we narrowed it down to two. I did reference checks on those two. And then ultimately, we are recommending tonight to award the contract to the Partnership for Rhode Island Street Lighting Management, otherwise known as PRISM. They emerged as a clear choice for a variety of reasons. One is during my reference checks, they came back with very positive feedback from multiple communities that they've done work for. They've done extensive work in Rhode Island. They've done thousands of streetlights. And the biggest thing is that they've done thousands of streetlights with Rhode Island National Grid and locally. So a lot of the firms from around the country may have done some in Maine and Pennsylvania, but the nuances of calculating everything here and dealing with National Grid, there's some nuance in it. And so I felt confident that this team could take that on. They have a strong customer support team, and that came out during the references that when a fix needed to happen, they responded. The call center was great to work with. And then the bid, quite honestly, was $1 million less, which never hurts. Overall, on our pricing, they came in on average about $1 million less on all of the components that would make up the system. So it was somewhat of a no-brainer from our standpoint. So where do we go from here? Ideally, if you were to approve tonight, we'd work with the PRISM team to develop a defined design for the system. We'd run life cycle costs and refine those. We've already run quite a few pro formas and financial statements to get us at that $700,000 savings number. We'd pilot the fixtures in the field, make sure, you know, looking at the cutoffs of the fixtures, making sure there's not too much glare, looking at color temperatures, really trying to dig deep to make sure that we make the right fit for the city based on all the experience of the team. We would have to purchase the inventory. So by inventory, I mean the arms, the actual fixtures themselves, some poles. So National Grid obviously owns a lot of wood poles that their electricity goes on, but there's also independent poles that we would prospectively own. The approximate cost of that is about $50,000, which the good thing is that that's not a bad price. The bad thing is the reason it's not a bad price is a lot of the infrastructure is old and has depreciated, which means we'll have probably a little bit more rewiring to do when we do the conversions. But on the flip side of that, we'll be addressing all of those needs in one shot. We'll have to maintain the system. And that's something we have to do. National Grid requires that we maintain the system while we do the conversion. We'll initiate the conversion of the system, and then we'll have to do ongoing maintenance moving forward. So just, I know that maybe a question that members come to me with, I just want to be upfront with perspective schedule on everything. Again, this is subject to change also based on weather, because you'll see that we begin conversion effort mid-January, which if it's anything like this past year, we'll be able to blow forward without any problems. If it's snowy winter, we may be slowed down a bit and it may push the schedule out. But you can see, basically, we're hoping to purchase from July to October from National Grid the inventory. Call center operations and maintenance will be online by October 2020, prospectively. We ramp up the conversion and get to the conversion over the winter months, hoping to convert the entire completion in July. And like I said, this contract will be extended to cover the call center operations, prospectively a year from now. So before the system is even fully converted, you'll be reviewing it, and I expect that I'll be making another presentation. I also want to do tonight, just be upfront, because I know many of you received, I want to make sure that I enter this as a project manager being very forthright with you, and I'm always open to questions. And some already came up. There was an email that was sent out in January, posing some concerns about system designs and about colors of temperatures and lights. And they cited an AMA study. This specific group called Soft Lights managed to get a little bit of traction in emails and basically just threw a little wrench in things, I think prematurely, because we haven't gotten to the system design yet. I just wanted to address it because that AMA report has been refuted quite a bit. It was basically a publication that was based on other literature. So they looked up words like lighting and health and LEDs and took this sort of aggregate of knowledge and pieced it all together into this paper that asserted that streetlights may be unhealthy in some ways if done, quote unquote, incorrectly. And so it was a very limited scope. It had a lot of assumptions in it. We could speak to you at length, but I will tell you that what eventually came out of it is not all of the suggestions are bad, right? Color temperature is not a specific LED necessarily thing. Color temperatures have to do with the technology and the ability to get different color renderings. I will say that we are going to keep this in mind going forward through the design process, but it won't be the basis of all our decisions because, quite honestly, I don't think it would be responsible to make that study the basis of all of our decisions. So I will say that millions of LEDs have been installed throughout the United States in offices, residential houses, and those Kelvins of temperatures, for those who don't know a Kelvin, it's basically an indication of how warm a light is, how it looks. So for those who are familiar with daylight bulbs, those are about 1,000 Kelvins. For those who are looking for that warm white Christmas light look, that's around 2,700 to 3,000. What they're advocating for is more of that warm look, reducing the blue spectrum, which I think is doable. The original LEDs, for those who remember about 10 years ago when they first came out, they're 5,000 Kelvin. They're this like really ice white blue spectrum. And that's really a lot of what they referred to. Those aren't really even used or available as much. We're going to be using 4,000 and below. DOT uses 4,000 on highways. It's likely we'll probably be around 3,000. So I won't belabor that, but I just want you to know that ultimately the design will address public health and public safety first. And that's what we're looking at, vehicular, pedestrian safety. We obviously don't want to endanger our residents, and we will take that into account. And you can see the differences in the colors of the Kelvins just in this photo. So the upper picture is probably about 2,700, which is a lot of what we have now. The bottom might be, you know, more towards the 4,000, probably less. I'll let some of my team members who are online maybe chime in on that. But you can see the glare difference. And you can see the spill difference. Look at that neighbor's house at night. So there is a lot of benefits to this. So we're going to be based on decisions on data, on the team we have involved, and we will consider anybody's input, but ultimately we have to do what's best for our city. We're gonna, you know, again, prospectively, this gets approved tonight. We're gonna finish the design and we're gonna move forward from here. And does anybody have any questions?
Thank you, Tim. I'm sorry, Lucas. You did a very good job working with this. I know it's been a lot of effort on your part and your colleagues and the mayor as well. And certainly it's something that we've discussed over and over for some period of time. I think it's important for all of us to consider the benefits of this in addition to the lighting, of course. One of the big questions comes up is the payback. And you addressed the payback. You had said it's approximately 3 years for that. So I'm just going to touch on a few highlights just to reiterate. So we have about 9,000 poles here in the city. And I know for certain, every single person in this city council has had our share of calls from constituents where street lights are out. We have red cap street lights, which can be a very onerous process to try and get those red caps removed and get those lights lit. We have some poles that perhaps don't need a light at all. This is going to light up all the poles in the city, all the lights that we have now. 9,000 will be lit, so we'll no longer have any red cap lights. I know it's sometimes a torture to get these lights replaced when they burn out or they're struck by a storm, whatever. And I'm particularly happy to hear about the 5-day replacement and the 2-hour for emergency services. The concern with the lighting effects that you just spoke to, I'd like to just point out that I think there's a lot more folks, not only in Rhode Island, but throughout the country that are using these same technologies for their street lights. So this isn't certainly anything that has just grown out of the city of Warwick. And I know for certain that the grid for many years has been installing free LED lights in people's places of business. We have LED lights in our homes. We have LED lights in our flashlights, in our headsets. So they're certainly all over the place. And I think it's fair to say that the totality of all of that lighting between the homes, the businesses, smallest things as technology has it, is probably significantly more than we have with 9,000 streetlights. Is that a safe assumption, Lucas?
Yeah, I would say, as you said, you know, we work in environments every day that have much higher color temperatures, and to the point that National Grid also has programs, as you know, for interior retrofits, deep energy retrofits for school buildings, for office buildings, and that's all LED technology.
Lucas, are they also using, in addition to the schools, are they also using LED technology in hospitals and in doctor's offices and chiropractor's offices and therapists and clinical workers, et cetera?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay. Any questions from members of the committee? Councilman McAllister.
Thank you. Lucas, I just want to thank you. That was a great presentation. You laid it out exactly, all the steps. You highlighted how you had a number of vendors. You had even 24 attend the pre-bid meeting, 8 proposals that you received, that you went through all of them to get it exactly what you were looking for. You know, you talked about the savings we're going to see annually, the savings we're going to see over the life of the bond. These are very important things. But as Chairman Lattiser pointed out, we get calls all the time from individuals when these lights go out. People are working third shift. They're coming home late at night or early in the morning. The light is out. There's nobody around. You know, and then we're waiting 2-3 months sometimes to get these lights fixed. And I think this would be a major improvement. I think this is a great program. I thank you and the administration for all the work that you did. We saw the timeline in this. You've been doing a lot of work on this for a long time. And I think that was a really good presentation that you gave us today that lays out exactly what the next steps are, where we were, where we are, where we're going. So I look forward to supporting this tonight. Thank you.
Thank you, Councilman. And it should be noted that, you know, when the mayor assigned me this task, you know, he really wanted to make sure that we did, as you know, we had a prior effort on this. And Mayor Solomon wanted to make sure we did quite a bit of due diligence on this one. He did not want to approach it the same way. And so you can see that tonight, you know, it took a while, about a year and a half, but I think, you know, we accomplished that goal for the mayor, which was, you know, really see this process through in a methodical way, data driven. And I expect that to be the same way moving forward.
Thank you, Lucas. Thank you, Councilman McAllister.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Councilman Hopp.
Thank you, sir. I wanted to also ask Lucas, if I understood it correctly, one of the things that was on the slide is that, let's say the lights will be, because you mentioned about people's concern about the brightness of the lights, the lights will be allowed to be adjusted. So if there is an emergency, the lights in that one block area can be lit to be completely bright to assist in the emergency response vehicles, and then go back to a normal evening glow, if you will, when the emergency is all set, correct?
So yes and no. Okay. So I will say there's two things there. One is, can we adjust it at install? Absolutely. So things like light spill in the people's windows is an issue. So we will go through and we can put cutoffs. One of the specific fixtures we're considering has, I think it's up to like 9 different cutoffs. And we can apply to the fixture to cut that light off. As far as dimming up and down, it really depends on the control system that we select. We had gotten bids on 3 different types of controls, 2 of which have dimming smart capabilities, I'll say. One of them is full capability, so we get direct feedback from the fixture, everything else. But that comes at a cost, and at a cost of upwards of $600,000 to $700,000 additional, plus yearly maintenance costs. So when we had looked at this, I'll be very forthright. We're considering more of a dusk to dawn option with what we call a simple dimming. So it'd basically be pre-adjusted dimming to take advantage of the tariffs from National Grid, because they don't charge us based on actual usage. They charge us based on tariffs. So if we commit to adjusting those light levels down at a certain time, they will give us a better rate. All right. If we go forward with network controls, we could do prospectively what you were saying. Take a block, raise the light levels, lower the light levels at our own whim. In speaking with Providence specifically, they do have that capability. They haven't used it once. Okay. And so as we go through this analysis, and I've met with Mr. D'Amico on this, on the financial analysis, really looking at, okay, where's the payback? Does it make sense? I think we'll probably err in a direction of going with a simple on-off photo cell with the dimmer option. For the reason that we get greatest financial benefit. Plus, I don't know if Rhode Island DOT is going to take over the systems on state roadways. If they do, basically we lose all that investment, right? So I'm better at giving them very low-cost photo cells and let them stick on their own network controls. And then at that point later on, if we want to come back and add network controls, it's a plug-and-play option. It's literally a node that you screw on top of the light, and then you can create what they call a mesh network or a cloud-based system. I know that's a long answer, but I just want to be, you know.
You educated me, and that's what I was looking for, and I thank you, because there was so much information being put out there that you really kind of clarified what I was looking for, and that makes all the sense in the world to me. And I agree, I don't want to put the cart before the horse, so let's wait to see what the DOT, what they take on, and it's better to come back and seek improvements and build-ons. And I do want to say, going on what Councilman McAllister said, this is all part of the council and the mayor working together on the city safety initiative. And I can't thank you enough for all the work you've done on this. And I think you've done a phenomenal job, and I'm pretty excited moving forward. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You're muted, Mr. Chairman.
Now can you hear me?
Yeah.
Now can you hear me?
Yep.
Okay. So Lucas, could you just reiterate again what it would be costing the city going forward per year if we did not approve this lighting program?
Yeah, so I'm actually just looking at my spreadsheet right now. So our total current electrical cost and maintenance is around $961,000 a year. We would prospectively save $700,000 of that per year moving forward if we do this conversion and we switch over to our own maintenance and we save on the energy. And that, just to note, some may know, some may not know, we have a virtual net metering agreement for our solar fields, and we did account for those, that deduction and the savings. So that's a conservative estimate that incorporates our also reduction in savings on the overall bill for the net metering.
So this is a cost savings per year.
Right.
We're looking at an initial outlay of $3.1 million to have a rate of return of $720,000 upwards of $900,000 per year going forward, correct?
That's correct. And like I said, we didn't account for that bump in the tariff. And that also doesn't account if we don't do this now. Because if anybody knows National Grid, they've raised rates pretty consistently. So that doesn't account any future raises that National Grid does.
And with interest rates, so we're basically, I think, at the lowest run of the ladder as we're going to get on interest rates doing this now versus trying to tackle something like this in a couple of years from now. Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. The interest rates are phenomenally low. The refi market on houses is any indication, right? Everyone's refiing their homes. It's the same thing here. If you can get that money at low cost, you're actually beating out all the future costs that are going to be pending on that system and all the raised rates. So it's a great time to do it.
Thank you, Lucas. I also echo the comments from my colleagues here on the committee I think this is a very, very good job by everyone. Certainly due diligence was presented. Any other questions from members of the council?
Just a quick one, it's more of a statement.
Councilman Sinapi.
Now this whole LED switch will help solve a lot of issues, at least in Ward 8. So very much looking forward to this project going forward.
Thank you, Councilman. Any other comments from members of the council?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Councilwoman Travis.
Yes, again, I don't want to echo everybody, but Lucas, I want to thank you and you and the administration for all the work you did. When Mayor Sodomon brought this up, this is one of my biggest problems. Those red caps were a pain. I mean, I had so many people complaining about them. And it wasn't months, it was years that they've been complaining about them. And this is going to be such an improvement for the city, not only the savings, but I'm looking forward to having it done. The public's health and safety is the first issue, the most important issue. But if we can get the city to save money on the lightings, have better lightings across the city, it's 100%. And I always worked good with you, Lucas. You've worked very hard with the Oakland Beach Association with our master plans. And if it was all a year and a half that it took for you to do it, you did an ace. It was 100% perfect. So thank you so much.
Thank you, Councilwoman. Any other comments, questions from members of the council?
Yes, Mr. President. Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. President.
Lucas, I too agree that it's a great program. I know that Councilman Solomon at the time was pushing for this before he became the mayor. And I know a lot of us felt the same way. So I'm glad that it's finally coming to fruition. There were a couple of questions that I was interested in with regard to maintenance. In particular, regarding the poles, where these go. Do we have a forecast as to what we think maintenance will be? Because the other problem that I know I have and a lot of my council colleagues have are these poles that National Grid left over. I apologize. Should have shut that off. That a lot of these National Grid poles that are causing problems. And I'm not too sure what's going to happen in the future. Obviously, they have to maintain the poles for their electrical systems. We're maintaining the lights. So is there any cost associated with maintaining the poles?
So, and I do have members of PRISM and RPM on the line, so I could pull them in on this if the answer isn't sufficient. But the wood poles themselves are owned by National Grid. We're not buying that infrastructure. They need to carry cables for electricity, communications, other things. If that pole gets knocked down, the wood poles get put up by National Grid. There are a limited number of poles that we will buy, I think it was a couple hundred, that are freestanding light posts. So if those get knocked down, there will be provisions in our contract that under emergency maintenance provisions that they go out and will carry a cost. We did carry it in our pro forma financial document, a percentage, I think it was 20% of our yearly maintenance just for knockdowns, unexpecteds, above and beyond. And that actually was a recommendation from PRISM based on their experience in Providence to have a little bit of cushion just in case we happen to get a spike. As we know, going to the Appanag Circular later lately, I'm thankful that we don't have to take over those lights. But you can see the amount of knockdowns in that area. Ours are mostly on residential streets, which is a great thing because they don't tend to get hit as much. So we do have built-in provisions for that. That is part of the emergency response and then our maintenance plan. We built that in. And as far as the wood pole knockdowns, if they get knocked down, what they do is they basically tape our fixture to the pole and say, city, you put it up. You own the infrastructure, you put it up. At which point we would have PRISM go out, call out a contractor and put that up. And then we'd have to file an insurance claim if we could on the person, on the party that hit the pole. Hopefully that answers your question.
Yes. Suppose we're in a situation someday where people decide to start burying the lines. So National Grid doesn't need a pole. Is that something that we would be responsible for putting up our own poles?
I guess that's a fair question. They don't like to go underground as it is because it's so costly now. I couldn't project out that far, you know, of whether they would want to put that sort of investment in. I guess if they don't want to carry the poles, then they would prospectively, you know, we would have to go on to a single freestanding pole at that point. That would have to be something that would be discussed with National Grid. It's a, again, it's a fair question. I think unlikely to happen at this point, just because the cost to bury infrastructure is so high, especially in a city like ours that is already developed. If it was anything new, you know, as, you know, any new subdivision, that's going underground, obviously. So that's not a great answer, but I really don't know the answer to that question. I don't know why anybody can answer that question at this point. I would think it would have to be involved that National Grid coming to the table and proposing that and us coming to some sort of resolution.
And could you also talk a little bit about solar and how that works into lighting too, and what the future of solar is and how that could affect lighting costs?
I guess there's a couple different slants on that way. So could you be a little bit more specific, Mr. President? In which regard? Just financially, or?
Yes, and what the cost is for solar. In other words, go off the grid.
Yeah, so there's a lot going on with solar. That's almost like a whole nother topic, but we are plugged into a virtual net metering agreement with the city. We realize the savings loosely 25 to 30% on our electric bill, based on the billing that I've seen I pulled from finance. The reason I say approximately, it's sometimes tough to drill down because we have a third party, the money gets passed through, and figuring out our finite savings on that. But I will tell you that obviously solar infrastructure is getting larger. A lot of it is virtual net metering. So solar fields, let's say in the city or elsewhere, public entities can tap into. We're pretty much virtual net metered out. So we're not going to realize any additional savings. I don't believe the schools are on a contract. I actually sat down with Tony Ferrucci and the superintendent at one point recommending they get on virtual net metering on their side. That is something they could certainly take advantage of. Eventually, there'll be a somewhat saturation in the market, mainly because honestly, like you take here in Warwick, there's only a certain amount of land you can develop solar. So I don't see us completely getting off the grid. You know, what you will see is batteries are becoming more popular, battery banking. And so they're trying to store that energy for longer terms to take the stress off the system in high peak periods. But I think it's going to be a long time before we realize a real off the grid sort of future for everybody. And as you can see, a lot of it's transitioned to natural gas. How that impacts lighting in the near future, as far as we're concerned, we've already built in those savings into our prospectus, our pro forma. So, you know, we already have a conservative estimate of our savings. How solar will impact that? Probably won't, quite honestly, as far as street lighting is concerned. It may drive the market down. What I would expect is in the short term, National Grid will continue to raise rates because they have to maintain the infrastructure, and there's a big fight going on for National Grid that, basically, I have virtual net metering. I don't pay that portion of my bill because if I get a $0 bill, I don't pay the infrastructure cost. So that's a pretty good deal for me. But it's not a great deal for National Grid. So those rates are going to continue to go up until they'll probably come to a point where they can start eventually to go down. That's a really long answer, but it's a complex issue. So I don't know if that drives you.
So those... you know, you mentioned batteries. When you look at what's on Route 95 sometimes, is that stored in batteries?
For DOT lighting?
Yes, for the DOT lighting.
I can't answer that. I would say that probably no. Battery technology hasn't gotten to where it should be. And so most of that lighting it's the same electricity you and I get. There's nothing special about street lighting. It pulls from the same grid. It goes through the only difference is it doesn't go through a meter. It gets tariffed. So I would love it to go through a meter because I think we're getting overcharged. What they do is they set a tariff based on a median wattage. And then they basically charge everyone a kind of a lump rate. Eventually with new technologies, one thing I do see coming is with the new technologies, if eventually National Grid goes to a metering type format, I could see that the city would then want to invest in a network control system, because then you can get actual metered energy and we'd probably pay less. But right now it's just based on tariffs and you get incentives for different dimming. But no, as far as batteries are concerned, just bringing it back down around to that, no difference than what we're doing, than Rideout's doing, than Providence or anybody else. We're pulling off the grid just like your house, my house, everyone's.
And the last question I had was, do we have the ability to someday expand for 5G service and rent to the Verizons of the world?
So that's a fair point. I think as far as 5G is concerned, right now, if we go with a simple photocell system, it's not really affecting us, right? We're not creating a mesh network, which is a series of repeaters, and it basically creates a Wi-Fi network between the streetlights. And we're also not going with, Verizon has a fairly new system that's cloud-based. Basically, it's an individual node that communicates directly with a cell tower, and it aggregates that data in a cloud-based program. We're prospectively not doing either of those right now. I think it's honestly a little premature on the Verizon side, because I'm a little worried about contract costs in the future once you lock in with the provider. I do see with 5G, it's like anything, the ability to tap into things is going to expand. And we may want to evaluate in 5 or 10 years once things mature, whether it's prudent to move forward with a network control system. I think, you know, taking a slow approach to this is the way to go. And the reason I say that is, if you look at systems from 10 years ago that used 5,000 Kelvin light fixtures, that used network technology that is now outdated, you kind of look at them and point to them as the example and say, that's not me. That's not the way I want to go. So, you know, to your point, as far as 5G, I think it's prudent to let 5G mature a little bit until we jump into that market and really take advantage of that. But is it a perspective, you know, will we have the ability to tap in? Absolutely.
So nothing in what we're doing now is going to prevent us from possibly looking at another revenue source if that becomes feasible and appealing.
No, you're talking about small cell tower based technology and whatnot. No, those will go up independent. Street lights have nothing to do with that technology as per se.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Any other questions from members of the council? Are there any questions from members of the public?
We don't have any hand raised at this time.
Are there any questions from members of the public?
We do not have any hands raised at this time.
Hearing none, I would request a motion.
I move favorable action.
Seconded.
We have a motion for favorable. We have a second. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Thank you.
Thank you.
Next item, number 20, 2020-324, purchase new paratransit van, found on page 10.
Good evening. Chair Lattiser and members of the Finance Committee. I'm here tonight with Bob
Meg,
Smith.
Meg, just state your name for the record, please.
Oh, I'm sorry. Meg Underwood, the Director of Senior Services. I apologize.
Thank you.
And again, Bob Smith, who's the Transportation Planner, has joined me. So I am here to present the bid recommendation for the paratransit van for Transwick. Our fleet is aging rapidly and still in a great deal of use, although a little less so now during the pandemic. We secured funding through the Office of Healthy Aging, which is formerly the Department of Elderly Affairs, for this van back in January. We went out to bid, and the initial bids had to be rejected. We've been having problems with bids that would either include an interior step, which pose a problem for seniors, or steps that are too high, which also presents a problem for seniors. So in this last round of bidding, we did have a bidder who either met or exceeded the specifications, and that is Don Brown Bus Sales of Johnstown, New York. As I've indicated, there were two bids from Matthews Bus Service that came in lower, but again, there was the problem of the steps that simply are not workable for our older adults. So this bid is in the amount of $69,595. Again, that would be paid for in full through a grant, state designated grant.
Thank you, Meg. So I think it's important to reiterate the issue of the rise of each of these steps. In the building code, I believe the rise cannot exceed, it's either 8 inches or 8.5 inches, I forget exactly, per step. So 9.5 inches, that's a significant increase in the rise of that step, particularly for a senior. I think that's very important to recognize here. We're not talking about a vehicle that's going to be transporting young adults, children, middle-aged folks. We're talking about a vehicle that's going to be transporting seniors who certainly have, and I can speak to that as a senior. We have our aches and pains and difficulties going up and down stairs. To have a rise of 9.5, which exceeds the building code by at least an inch, I can see where that's problematic. Meg, I do have a question. What is the difference between those vehicles that have that excessive rise in the step and the $69,595 that you're asking for?
I believe they're using different chassis. The one that we were quoted by Don Bus Sales is a 2021 Starcraft All-Star. It is a Ford chassis. My understanding is that the Chevy may possibly have a chassis with smaller steps, although nobody quoted on that, and that was laid out in the specifications. But the Chevy chassis have a step. Once the senior has gone up the three steps and they're on the floor of the bus, the Chevys, and unfortunately we have one right now, has a short step, like a lip, which is really, really the worst thing you could do for a senior is to surprise them with I think it's like a 5-inch lip. And I think that's the difference. I do not know why the other bus companies, especially when we did a rebid for that exact reason, ignored that specification, but that's what happened.
So now you bring up even a more significant concern is not only do we have an excessively high rise, we also have a short step. And right. That is, that's definitely, a building code violation as well. I understand we're not talking about a building, but you might as well be talking about a building when it comes to a senior that has to go in the street, up the driveway, and climb up these particular stairs to access this van. But Meg, you didn't, at least I didn't hear, you tell me what the difference was in the bids.
Oh, I apologize. The price of bid, I apologize. I thought I had put that in the letter and I didn't, but hang on and I will get that for you. The Matthews one was $63,974. And I apologize.
Bob, I got it right here, Meg.
Thanks, Bob. I was hoping you were there.
Matthews submitted two bids, one with a GM chassis for $63,974 and one with a Ford chassis for $4,494. And the Don Brown bid was for $69,595. The Matthews, both bids with the Matthews, for both Matthews vehicles, they weren't compliant with that, with the step specifications. There was a 9.5-inch rise on both buses, and there was an additional lip in the aisle with the GM vehicle. So that's the reason we're going with Don Brown. He has a 7.5-inch rise, the 9-inch tread, and no lip, no obstruction beyond the top step. So he was compliant in all counts.
Thank you, Bob. So, you know, in the bidding world, which I deal with all the time, if one chooses to vary from the RFP and what the particular entity is looking for, then you run the risk of not being compliant with the bid. I don't see where there's any differences here in the monies that certainly would change my mind with regard to the potential for seniors to have a problem both entering and leaving this vehicle. And it's even compounded knowing that we have a trip hazard there as well. So with that said, I would like to ask, before I move on to members of the committee. So Meg, tell us again what the necessity is, why this vehicle is needed at this particular time, and what's the significance of not providing this vehicle?
Sure. I actually am probably going to have Bob give you a background on the age of our current vehicles. You know, obviously, during this pandemic, the vehicles are being used to deliver meals to folks who can't get out. We're currently sending out somewhere in the neighborhood of 200 to 300 meals per day on the buses. But in normal times, we are making about 600 trips per week with these vehicles, and they are aging. So Bob, do you want to add to the background of the age and shape of the vehicles we're using now?
Yes, sure, certainly. We have a total of 6 buses in service right now. The four newest buses are one 2013 GM and three 2014 GMs. All four are gas vehicles. The two oldest vehicles in the fleet are 2007 Ford diesels, which are in constant need of repair. So the maintenance is getting excessive. The components on these vehicles, such as wheelchairs, wheelchair lifts, AC units, front and rear, are starting to fail. So, and those are two of the big factors with the seniors that we're transporting. We want to be comfortable while they're in the vehicle, and if we have vehicles on the road that don't provide AC in the summertime, it's a critical situation. We had a third diesel bus that was we had retired this year because it was just too costly to repair. The other two are catching up to that. We're just chasing good money after bad in the older vehicles. And as far as the four newer gas vehicles, they, believe it or not, you know, they're getting every year goes by faster and faster. So we're looking at vehicles that are 6 years old. The shelf life of these vehicles basically are only about 10 to 12 years before the failures start to catch up with it, and it becomes too costly to repair and maintain. So at this point, we get the funding from the state, from the Office of Healthy Living. It's a perfect opportunity. You know, right now our mission has changed quite a bit since the corona situation. Hopefully, once we get through this situation, we'll go back to where we what we were doing before, and as far as our number of trips per week, and so the a new bus at this time would be well worth it.
Thank you, Bob. Last question I have is, was this on the capital purchasing budget that was submitted for this year?
Yes, it was, Councilman. This was something that we believed would come through from the state. It took some time to get the contract correct and get it signed and everything before we could go out to bid, but it was on the capital expenditures for this year.
Thank you, Meg. Any questions from members of the committee? Councilman McAllister.
Thank you, and I want to thank the director. She had reached out to me about this. This is a state grant. It's definitely well needed, as Bob and Meg spoke about. Also, there's some timing issues on this that we want to be aware of, because it is a state grant. We have to follow their timeline, so it is due soon. So Meg wanted to make sure that she got this before us. I think we're all in agreement that this is a great purchase for our seniors, and I look forward to supporting it tonight. Thank you.
Thank you, Councilman. Any other questions from members of the committee? Hearing none, any questions from members of the council? Any questions from members of the public?
There are no hand raised this time.
Do we have any questions from members of the public?
No hands raised at this time.
Thank you. Hearing none, I need a motion.
I move favorable action.
Second.
Seconded.
We have a motion favorable. We have a second. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Thank you, Meg.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Bob. Good job.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Council.
Sorry. Next on the list, 2016-081, State of Rhode Island Paint Supplies, found on page 22. Hi, Christy. State your name for the record, please.
Good evening, everyone. Christy Moretti, Department of Public Works. The department actually would like to withdraw this request.
At the request of the sponsor, we have a motion to, I will make a motion to withdraw. Need a second?
Second.
We have a motion. We have a second. Any discussion? Hearing none, we have a motion. We have a second. All in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Thank you.
Motion is to withdraw. Thank you, Christy. Item number four, 2016-081B, State of Rhode Island Paint Supplies, found on page 31.
James Scott, Parks and Recreation.
Hi, James.
Hi, how are you doing, Chairman? We would also like to withdraw this request.
Make a motion to withdraw at the request of the sponsor. I need a second.
Mr. Chairman.
Sir.
In order to remove these items from the consent calendar, we need to put them in unfavorable action. So if we could go back to the prior item and do a motion to reconsider on bid 2016-081A. And follow that with a motion for unfavorable action, and that will keep it in line within the consent calendar itself.
Okay, let's go back up to 2016-081 at the request of the solicitor, council solicitor, that is. I make a motion for unfavorable action. Need a second?
Second. Do we have to bring it back first?
Sure.
Yeah, all right, so bring back.
Reconsider.
Reconsideration on 2016-081. Withdraw the original bid. Withdraw the original motion.
Yeah, I second that.
Okay, we have a motion to withdraw the original. We have a second. All in favor?
Aye.
Okay, we need a motion for unfavorable action on 2016-081.
I unfavorable action.
Second.
We have a motion for unfavorable. We have a second. All in favor?
Aye.
Thank you. Item 2016, same issue. We're going to need a motion for unfavorable action.
I make a motion for unfavorable action.
We have
seconded.
Unfavorable. We have a second. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Thank you. 2016-171, State of Rhode Island Software Government Procurement, and that is found on page 40.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Phil Carlucci, MIS Director. I'm going to follow suit and respectfully request this be withdrawn.
You guys are making our job easy. I need a motion for unfavorable action.
I make a motion for unfavorable action.
Seconded.
We have a motion for unfavorable. We have a second. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Hold on. We need PCRs for all of those?
No, by having the... Hold on one second, please.